appearance that airport officials should have to explain obvious violations in their security plan that may have led to the bombing. Domodedovo Airport has metal detectors at airport entrances, but they're only used occasionally, meaning anyone can enter the main terminal area away from the gates. Witnesses say yesterday's attack was carried out by someone who brought a suitcase to the International Arrivals Hall, never having to be screened. Domodedovo is the same airport that had a major security lapse in 2004. Suicide bombers were able to bribe their way through security and onto two separate flights. Shortly after takeoff, both planes blew up, killing 90 people. David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
Across the U.S., activists on both sides of the debate over electronic cigarettes are closely watching developments in New York, where another effort is underway to ban the device. Some lawmakers want more federal research on the product, arguing the device is just another addictive habit. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from USA Network with the original series White Collar, starring Matt Bomer and Tim DeKay. More at whitecollar.usanetwork.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman about Europe's economic crisis, how it connects to the euro, and what it would mean if the euro failed. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
And good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour one. Harriet Williamson is our producer. We were expecting in this program, this part of the program, to talk about stroke. And our guest, scheduled guest, Dr. John Wang, he's a neurosurgeon from Carle Foundation Hospital Stroke Center. Sorry that we can't have the show here that we planned. We'll maybe see if we can get the doctor to join us on another day. So with that, we'll go to the archives for a program for this hour. So as you listen, do keep in mind that for this hour, we'll not be taking calls. In this first hour, we'll be talking with journalist Anand Giridharadas. He was born in the United States in Ohio. His parents were born in India. And his impressions when he was young of India were formed both by the kinds of things that his parents said and also by occasional visits that the family would make to visit relatives in India. When he was much older, when he was in college, he moved to India and worked there as a management consultant. And he says that when he arrived at that point, he found that the impressions that of India that he was still carrying around with him from his childhood really just didn't fit anymore. He said he felt this was a country where there was a new sense of confidence, and for him, perhaps it raised some new questions about what it means to be Indian or Indian American. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Anand Giridharadas about his recent book. It's titled India Calling: An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Times Books is the publisher. He writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. As I said, he worked in Bombay as a management consultant until 2005, when he began reporting from that city for the Herald Tribune and the Times. Well, Anand, good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's great to be here.
We appreciate it. Just to talk a little bit more about your personal story, as I said, your mom and dad were born in India. Your dad came to the United States for the reason that a lot of people came to the United States, because there was a good opportunity, and your mom came along. What was it that your father, did he come here for school, or did he already come here because there was a job here?
First came for school in 1977, having worked in India, having gone to college in India, had a business degree in India, worked in India, and collided with a kind of stagnancy of the system And very simply put it to me once that he kind of looked at his bosses 20 years ahead of him in line and concluded that he didn't want to spend his next 20 years becoming them. And so first came to America to study and do an MBA at Harvard, and then having done that, got a job in Cleveland, Ohio, where I guess all Indians in that era dreamed of ending up, and came moved to Cleveland in 1979.
Yeah, and this and your parents' marriage, I understand, in, unlike a lot of marriages at the time, this was not an arranged marriage.
It was not. It was a love marriage, remains a love marriage, and it was, you know, this trend was obviously beginning in those years and has now deepened. In a way, India today is still going through this revolution of a kind of, I call it a kind of Romeo and Juliet revolution of people realizing that love matters more than kind of family compatibility when it comes to choosing a partner.
Mm-hmm. One of the big things that you talk about, one of the big changes between the time when you were a boy and now, has to do perhaps with the current, which way the current flows, so to speak, between India and the United States, and the fact that, for example, that your dad came here because of the opportunities, both educational and for work, and that a lot of people did that, and that nobody at the time would have thought to go the other way. That is, nobody would move from the United States to India because of opportunity. But you say that that's actually one of the things that has changed.
It has changed, and you know, it would have been unimaginable a generation ago to think about an eastbound flow of immigrants. At that time, India was a place where a combination of kind of historical sources of stagnancy, the caste system and other things like that, as well as the kind of more recent phenomenon of India's socialist experiment, had strangled opportunity for a lot of people. And America was a very different place, a place where you could be and do anything, it seemed. And fast forward to today, and a lot of young Indians, often the children of those who left, a group that I belong to, have come of age in a time when obviously the American economy is suffering. But I think more than that, have come of age in a time when it's easier to be proud of India. And a lot of young people have begun to explore moving back to the places their parents left, and reclaiming those places, cross-pollinating between America and those places. And it's a really fascinating shift in the nature of migration.
Hmm. I think it's also interesting that the kind of people that are being drawn there. I'm sure that there are people who go there for business opportunities, although one might argue, I'm sure, that India doesn't need any more software engineers. That many of the people apparently are going are people who you'd say maybe are in the more creative, artistic fields, and that they are seeing real opportunities to do things that fuse the new and the old, that respect and yet advance traditions, and that it is in fact people like that who are being drawn there and having a lot of success.
Absolutely, and you know, Richard Florida made a lot of money coming up with this wonderful phrase, creative
class. Yeah.
And I think what we are seeing today, although I have no illusions about making the same amount of money from this idea, is the fusion class. That there's a class of people in the world who are uniquely situated to kind of mediate and cross-pollinate between countries. And it's very interesting. You're absolutely right that India does not need more software engineers. It also doesn't need more, you know, bank tellers and things like this. But there, when it comes to, say, creating a really great top-of-the-line restaurant in Bombay, there just hasn't been a history of those kinds of restaurants indigenously in the last 50 years. Those are the kinds of things, or fashion boutiques, or bringing in a certain kind of radio show that doesn't exist in India. Those are the kinds of things that in a way need some amount of technology transfer, human technology transfer. And those are the kinds of gigs that have drawn a lot of these second generation returnees and others, people who maybe grew up in India or grew up in America, ran a restaurant here, and then go to Delhi and start a restaurant that kind of combines both something indigenous in India that they perhaps see and value more than someone who's taken it for granted growing up there, and elements of the West that an Indian may not have such easy access to.
Yeah. And so you really made the argument, and I think now certainly there are a lot of people who are talking about the potential of India to be an even more, it's certainly important now, but to be an even more important player in the world economy and to have great impact because both of the virtue of its size and its human capital. But you seem to be making the argument that the people here that are really going to be important are the young people, people that you're talking about now, who are growing up now, or perhaps in their 20s now, that you've said something like, I watched a little interview that you did, that the young people of India you think may well be the most important next generation in the world.
That's right, and I think there's an important explanation for that, which is, if you think about a country like the United States, there's a certain pace of change. Even when big changes happen, like the recession or the technology boom or different things, life itself, the texture of life itself, values, everything, actually changes quite slowly. People continue to kind of eat the same way they've eaten and more or less believe the same things they've believed. When a country is going through what India is going through right now, it's much more like what the U.S. was going through in the 19th century, which is this kind of complete breakneck pace reinvention. And everything is up for grabs. The nature of family is being reinvented. The nature of individuality is being reinvented. The nature of love is being reinvented. When things are moving so quickly and so holistically, in some ways, it's very difficult for people who are of a certain age, too old, to kind of adapt to those changes. And what really changes a country like that and the people who manage it are just the people who are too young to remember anything else. And so there's a generation of Indians who are coming of age who were, you know, 5 or 10 or less when these changes began in the late 80s and early 90s. And it's in many ways those Indians who are completely unencumbered by the baggage of the past who don't know India to have been anything else but a place in which possibility was something you could take for granted.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Anand Giridharadas. He's a journalist. He writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and New York Times Online. He's native of Cleveland, Ohio. He went to school at Michigan. He worked in Bombay as a management consultant about the time he was about to finish up college. Says he's thinking about going back to India. He worked there as a management consultant and then began reporting from Bombay for the Herald Tribune and the Times. And he's written a book about some of his experiences. The title of his book is India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Times Books is the publisher. 333-9455. If you'd like to call in, that's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, just to take a step or two back, as I explained, and you write about it in the book, that when you were a kid, that periodically your family would go back to India to spend time with family. And so from that, you got a certain impression of what India was all about, at least the India of that time. So, and I gather that you really were not very excited about the opportunity of going and spending time in India then.
I wasn't. And, you know, partly it's the kind of folly of youth, because when you're that young, going to India for me was not just about going to a place. It kind of represented me in a certain way. And so I was looking for, what does this place say about me? And it was funny that as soon as we would go, not even to India, but from Cleveland to New York, where the only place we could get a flight towards India, India would already kind of present itself in New York in the line to board the flight to India, because people would suddenly start pushing and pulling to get on the plane, even though there were assigned seats. And as soon as you got out in India, as soon as the plane landed, it just was so apparent, particularly to a young child, that this was another world. Not just a different place with different sights and sounds, but a place with a kind of diminished idea of human possibility. And the bodies, the thing that most kind of stuck in my memory as a child was the bodies that you saw in the aero bridge when you got out of the plane in India, laborers in the airport, were of a qualitatively different kind than the bodies on the other end and the bodies in the plane. They were smaller, they're, you know, 25% less meat on the bone. And it was just one small thing that then was a preview of kind of the beggars on the street and all of this stuff. And, you know, people often say these are all cliches of India, but they're cliches because they were true. And even more than that, even when you got past that and spent time with my own family and gatherings of friends, there was a sense in India of it being a kind of place where nothing moved. People kind of said the same things, believed the same things. Their ideas never changed. And I was particularly struck comparing myself to children, cousins of exactly the same age, who knew so much, were so bright, were so well-educated. But once you put one adult in the room, could not muster the courage to say anything. And it just seemed, from all of those things, to be a kind of shrunken place, a frozen place. And it was a place that until I got much older, I didn't want to really associate myself with.
So why is it then you did make that decision? That this was, I guess, when you were in college and nearing the end of your undergraduate time there at college, that you started thinking about going back and actually moving there and living there for a time.
It was actually, you know, it now seems very heavy and inevitable, but it didn't seem like that at the time, like all life decisions. I think I was a senior in college. The only thing I knew fairly certainly is that I wanted to be a writer. But as you know, it's not exactly self-evident how you become a writer. You can't just go to New York and join one of the big writing firms. So I was a bit confused, and I think the idea that came to me was to go to a place that was interesting, because writing is so much about kind of being transformed by a place. And even if it meant doing a job that was apart from writing, going to an interesting place would stimulate me. And once I had that idea, India, you know, I thought about Belgium and places like this, and then at some point, it just seemed that if I had this kind of complicated history with India, you often notice that the subject you first hate in school ends up being the subject that you spend your life on, and the country you most hate ends up being the one that launches your adult career. And that's what happened with me. I just thought, maybe I need to go deal with this.
Yeah. Well, you we talked a little bit about how you would visit with your family when you were a boy, and how that you had a certain kind of impression in the place, particularly of it being this place that was really, as you described it, kind of dead and stagnant and not a very exciting place, and not really a place that you were excited about being. A place that was really hidebound, and where tradition was really important, and where people's, whatever their dreams perhaps were just stifled. They felt that it was just not a place where you could dream about doing something or being something and then actually have any hope of realizing that.
Right.
So now you're in 2003, you come back, come to Bombay. And this was a place that you probably in some sense felt you knew something about it, at least based on everything your parents ever told you and your experiences when you were younger. But you found at this point, you say you found a very different place, and it sounds as if it was a little bit of a shock.
When I arrived in August of 2003, it was as if I had landed in another India. There was plenty that was still kind of existent from that older world, but there was so much that just did not fit into the frameworks I had built, and that's partly because the frameworks I had built were outdated, and partly because they had never been quite right to begin with, and I hadn't quite understood, and I had seen only what I was capable and wanted to see. But from the moment I arrived, just take one example of kind of arranged marriage thing, and I always had this sense that my parents only had, you know, this kind of love marriage, but everybody else had these arranged marriages, and love is kind of stifled and hidden, and, you know, on the streets you see men in India walking 5 feet ahead of their wives, and when they do hold their hand, it's not really their hand, but kind of pulling their wrist, like dragging them along like a kind of animal. And that was my picture, and I arrived in Bombay, and you go to clubs and bars, and people are behaving just like they behave where I am today in New York City. And sometimes, because all this is so new, behave in ways that people in New York City would be embarrassed to behave. And dancing on tables and having secret romances and cheating on spouses and doing drugs and, you know, and I'm not endorsing any of these things, but they were an instant kind of telegraphing to me of how much had changed and how much the picture of India in my mind needed revision.
Something else that I think is interesting is that the way that you were received was somewhat different, at least in the sense that maybe when you were younger, that would have been a time when people who had left, say had gone to the United States and were coming back to visit, were recognized and welcomed back as something special. You know, the ones who went and made it. And when you came back in 2003, the idea that you would be coming from the United States, at that point, there was nothing special about you anymore.
No, and, you know, when we were children, we would come back on those trips. You know, the American emigre families would always bring, like, Gap Cockies and Johnny Walker whiskey for our Indian relatives, things they couldn't get themselves. And that, in a way, was a symbol of this kind of, you know, our relatives over there who need us to, you know, help them with this access to the great products of the wider world. And again, by the time I got there in 2003, not only did they not need our khakis and whiskey anymore, they didn't quite seem to need us. I used to always have cousins in the 80s and 90s ask me, "Do you feel Indian or American? Are you Indian or American?" And, you know, you could tell that they really wanted me to say Indian because that would kind of dignify them by association. By 2003 and onward, no one cared, and they were very self-confident. Growth, it's funny, when we talk about economic growth, we tend to talk about it just economically, but growth is a very powerful cultural thing. Growth gives people confidence. It makes them believe in themselves. It makes them cease to want to be somebody else, and that's what was happening. And for me, it was perhaps the result was to receive a cooler reception than I expected. But for the country, you have to say how delightful to be from a place that you have no insecurity about and to be the kind of Indian today that could not imagine any fate more beautiful than being Indian.
Well, did you, when you were growing up in the United States, did you think much about that, what am I question, that am I Indian, am I an American, or was that something that you really didn't really... At that time, the idea, the identity of the hyphenated identity of Indian American wasn't really something that you even thought about.
It wasn't. You know, it's not that I was unaware of the duality, but I think the way the duality was lived for me was I felt American with an asterisk. And what I mean by that is we were kind of almost all American. So we did the American things and, you know, played in the backyard and played catch with my dad and all of that, all of the kind of trapping, and went to block parties and all of this stuff. But there were kind of exceptions, and the Indianness was the exceptions. It was that after all of that, we were not very strongly encouraged to play, you know, football and soccer, but kind of guided towards swimming and tennis. After all the kind of sociability with friends, at the end of the day, if American parents told their kids, you know, if someone hits you, hit back, we were told if somebody hits you, don't hit back. And, you know, just small little things like that. So for me, it was less this kind of 50-50 identity crisis and more kind of being American, but with a bit of a qualification. And I think, you know, I'm no psychologist, but I think that accounted for some of my discomfort with India, the country, although they have no direct relationship. It was partly the difficulty of the asterisk that made me kind of uncomfortable with what lay behind the asterisk, which is this big country that I didn't quite understand and that seemed to kind of make me unbearably different, and no one wants to be different at that age.
We have a caller we're going to bring into the conversation, someone who's listening this morning in Indiana. We'll talk with them on our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hi. There are two things. One, the first one that came to mind was when you were talking about the change when you got off the airplane, and you all of a sudden you realize you're an entirely different world than from the time before when you were much younger. I wonder if you could speak to that somewhat in a sociological sense, if possible, you sort of give your ideas of why you think it went that way. Then the second one deals with the sitting in the bar and seeing the same things going on there as are going on in all the bars in the United States. I just wonder if you give some sociological analysis of that. Is this is the way things are, no matter what culture you're from. If it switches over to the more, what are we going to call this thing for years from now, that the beer drinking and liquor drinking and the chase and the girls and all that kind of stuff is pretty damn unanimous everywhere. And the business world works it all out in some way or another. Or if you could just talk to that in a general sense to hear your ideas about it. Thanks.
Thank you. I think that's actually one of the most interesting questions I've heard in a long time. I've thought about that a lot, and I'm still thinking about it. But I think one of the big questions I came away with from my time in India, and even from writing this book, one of the big questions I'm still trying to answer is there one modernity at the end of all of this? And my sense is, and your example is exactly right, which is that it's actually quite stunning that at a place with thousands of years of civilizational history and its own languages and culture and traditions, etc., once you start to get a little bit of money and companies start to invest, everybody suddenly starts to behave in ways that quite resemble, you know, what modernity looks like everywhere else. I think my own sense of it is it's very piecemeal. And there are certain elements of modernity that are stunningly universal. For example, the kind of bar drinking and all of that stuff. And I think the interesting thing is to look at what is not. So let me speak to each of those very briefly. I think in terms of what ends up being universal is there's a certain idea of the self being the irreducible atom of the society that seems, and maybe there's something beyond the self eventually, but seems right now to be this kind of irreducible universal thing, that in all these countries are going through this transition, whether it's China or India or others, there's a relentless pressure in favor of the self at the expense of other things, the community, the neighborhood, the family, the clan, the caste, the race, whatever. When you liberate, empower, embolden, or turn selfish, depending on how you see it, the self, you're going to get a lot of the behavior we're talking about. I think what is different, perhaps, and India is an example of this, is even as the idea of the self asserts itself in places like India, in certain places, and India is a very powerful example of this, the self still is going to contend, and I would expect this to continue, with family, with clan, in a kind of balance, in a way that it hasn't in the West. And that's an open question. We don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But I think in some of these societies, people still fundamentally, deep down, maintain one eye on the community, even as the other eye focuses much more on the strong, robust self.
It seems, though, that you almost can't underestimate or understate what a big change this is, moving from a way of thinking that says that you, as an individual, are not as important as whatever group you're attached to, I suppose at the beginning that does end up being your immediate family, and then perhaps extended family, and then it may be a lot of other things. And what has changed, even though those things are still important, is a change to a mindset that says you are important as an individual, your fulfillment is important, and that if you have particular kinds of dreams, that you should go for it, and that's okay. It's striking that really is a very big change.
It's a huge change, and it's. I like the way you put it. I think I would often get some criticism from certain quarters when I was a correspondent in India, saying, you know, your articles talking about this change are just celebrating India becoming more like America. And what I would always say is, I think you have to separate saying that India is just becoming like America to saying India is becoming a place where selfhood matters and where the self is seen as something. And I'm not sure that America has a monopoly on that idea. I tend to be on the side of not kind of selfishness and rabid individualism, but saying who gets the right to tell selves that they can't be what they want to be.
And again, it's something that I think is really striking and an important theme in the book is, you know, to the extent to which people, and this may indeed be particularly true of younger people, are willing to fully embrace Western popular culture, certainly, and perhaps some things that you might label Western values, and at the same time want to retain a lot of Indian tradition and Indian values as well. And the interesting thing to watch, I'm sure, as time goes along, is going to be the way in which people take the two things and weave them together and, to some extent, make something that's new.
Absolutely. And I'll give you one very vivid example of this that really captures it for me. If you drive today on roads and highways in India, you will see signs every few miles for English Language Academy. Learn English, 500 rupees, $10. 2,000 rupees, $40. Learn English. You could conclude from this that Indians are English crazy right now. But there's a nuance. Indians today more than ever want to learn English. But less than ever do they want to be English. They don't want to be English anymore. English has become a tool, the language, for self-advancement. But at the same time that this economy has come in, that the use of English in work to get ahead has entrenched itself, at the very same time, a self-confidence is bubbling up in these very same people. And their desire to mimic the ways of English people, which earlier generations of Indian elites did after the colonial period, is really diminishing. And those are the kinds of contradictions that you're seeing right now in India, that you could judge India as being in a westernizing boom right now, but in many ways India is in an Indianizing boom.
We're at our midpoint. Let me very quickly introduce again our guest before going on to a caller. Anand Giridharas writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. Grew up in the United States, of Indian parents, spent some time living in India. First, he went to work as a management consultant and then became a journalist, reporting for the Herald Tribune and the Times from Bombay. And he is the author of a recently published book, India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. And it is published by Times Books. We have a caller. Others, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller on line one in Champaign. Hello.
I wondered about the possibility that the colonialism in both the U.S. and India isn't much more a difference of what I would call corporate growth, corporate colonialism, like Coca-Cola in India, Bata, and the development of some of the power industries in the United States, like BP and the Gulf Coast. But what is the difference between we have in Champaign, Urbana, a very Anglophile love situation. I mean, most of the academics give me the impression of being horribly English. And has the caste system in India in any way begun to resemble the caste system that we have here in Champaign-Urbana?
Well, I must say I'm not an expert on the caste system in Champaign-Urbana, but I will speak to part of what you said, which is one of the questions a lot of people ask is the kind of corporate, multinational, capitalistic India a kind of total break from and deliverance from the past of hierarchy and caste and all of that, or is it something more nuanced? I think it's more nuanced, but it's a kind of strange mix of both. For those who kind of, I mean, you know, the caller used the word corporate colonialism. I think you have to, first of all, before you say that, acknowledge, at least as I saw it on the ground in India, that companies, even the most kind of hardened anti-corporate person, cannot ignore the fact that companies are doing remarkable things in a place like India. And they're doing truly terrible things. But both are true. And the world, unfortunately, organizes itself in these camps of people who like everything companies do or hate everything companies do. The truth is subtle. When you go to one of these new Indian malls, however garish they are, however stupid the stuff they sell is, however kind of empty the consumer mentality that they're stoking is, when you see those kind of 23-year-old kids from a village or small town who now have a steady salary job at a mall and have a confidence in their faces and whose bodies display a confidence that their father's bodies and grandfather's bodies did not display, you have to say, you know, something good is happening in the world here. At the same time, what some of the mining companies are doing, what some of the industrial companies are doing to move poor people off the land, not resettle them appropriately, deprive them of their livelihood without giving them a meaningful alternative livelihood, is terrible. In a way, it's nothing different than what happened in this country in its own period in the 19th century, whether it's the kind of Gilded Age or whatever is the best comparison. I think you have to really appreciate the way in which corporate growth in India is a deliverance from the old world of hierarchy by intrinsic human worth. It breaks that up. And to that extent, it's a liberating force. And I think once that force entrenches itself in the next 5-10 years, there's going to be a whole raft of problems with it. And I think there'll probably be a pushback, and probably should be.
Hmm. Just for a moment to go back and pick up on the notion of caste, I'm sure that there are people who would make the argument that in the past, if India was a place that was stagnant, one of the things that contributed to that stagnation was lack of social mobility, and that the idea that they were really bound up by this idea that says where you were born in the social hierarchy was where you will stay. That is, people did not advance, or if there was possibility for advancement, it was very, very small. Well, that is something that certainly has changed, but how much has that changed?
I'm sorry, say the last part again.
It seems that has changed, but the question is, to what extent has that changed?
That's an interesting question. I think it's changed depending on who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, if you are living in a village in India and you are still very much in the net of caste and those hierarchies, and people know which part of the village you live in, and that defines your identity and the markings on your head and clothes you wear and the food you eat, the new India doesn't feel that new for you. On the other hand, if you're in a city and you are somewhat removed from the kind of intricacies of caste, your possibilities are much greater today. But I think something that people don't often focus on enough is that something like caste, which is quite like race-based discrimination in this country, doesn't go away just because you ban it. It doesn't go away just because you have a few affirmative action programs. It often just kind of, it's an energy that changes form in a way. And the form in which it now exists in India is this kind of idea that human beings come in different kind of tiers of humanness. And that idea is also under attack today, and there's a lot of young people in particular who don't think in that way. A friend of mine who's a leading Indian psychoanalyst once said, India is the world's largest and most plural democracy with the world's most undemocratic people. And there's some truth in that.
Well, if, you know, say, imagine someone, maybe in fact you could think of someone who fits this mold, imagine somebody who was born on one of the very low rungs of the social ladder, but by virtue of his intelligence, his drive, maybe some luck, managed to become a billionaire and live in the way that money can make it possible to live. How would people feel about that person?
It's interesting. One of the people I talk about in India Calling is Mukesh Ambani, who lived that very kind of story that you described. And his father built this company from nothing, and now he runs it, one division of it. And the story of his rise is very much the story of a rise of a class of scrappy Indian business leaders who the old kind of Anglophile colonial elite regards as kind of crass and nouveau riche and all about money. But a lot more Indians that I met in small towns and villages regard as heroes. And it was quite telling that he built this kind of multi-million-dollar mansion, the kind of vertical 27-story mansion, right in the middle of downtown Bombay near slums. And it was funny, all the people who hated it were rich people. And all the people on the TV interviews and when I've talked to people also who admire it are poor people. It's they who say maybe this signals the coming of a new India where a lot of other people can build 27-story towers in the middle of Bombay.
Our guest, Anand Giridharadas, is a journalist. He writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and New York Times Online, and he is author of a recently published book. It's titled India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking, and it's published by Times Books. Questions welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in the show. We have a couple of callers. We'll go on to the next. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. There's so much I admire about the culture, and I do have the misgiving about it being, quote-unquote, modernized, westernized. And I think that there's some complexities here that that I've been trying to inform myself about. I listened to Arundhati Roy quite a bit, and Vandana Shiva, and listening to the voices from below, basically, and many people in India are below a dollar a day, so there's this veneer of modernization, I'm afraid, is frankly all it is at this point. And there's just a lot of unsettling things, as we have repression here in our country. A critic of the government has just been given a life imprisonment in a very shocking story that I can't recount here, and it's pretty complex, but Roy herself is under some kind of court summons or some proceedings to because she wrote something about the unrest in the Maoist regions in the east, sort of the hinterlands, more of these hinterlands. So recently, there's been a discussion on the show about microfinance, et cetera, and it points out there's been at least a short-term failure of it, and it evidences itself in India with this widespread suicide of cotton farmers who are in a debt trap and see poison themselves with the expensive pesticides that they've bought with these loans, seeing no way out. It's an unsettling circumstance, and I just worry about this kind of thing in a very global way, because this kind of economic destabilization leaves openings for, you know, the now discredited BJP, but, you know, they were in ascendancy not so long ago. And I just think that there's a whole complexity here that people like Tom Friedman, who write about, you know, world being flat, or just in using India as in Bangalore and that kind of metropolitan growth as some kind of indication of what's really happening, and it seems to be a really grave misapprehension. So there's not a question there, but I'd like for you to respond.
Yeah, you've certainly put a lot of interesting things there on the table. Anand, you can take on some of that.
I think I need another hour, but let me try. You know, I think the caller is right about much of what he said, and I don't mean to give the impression that the changes I'm talking about here have touched everybody. They haven't. India has more poor people than sub-Saharan Africa. Think about that for a minute. About half of Indian children today are undernourished. So I think you have to separate two different things. One is are the changes that are happening simply not reaching as far as they should, or are they making things worse? What I'm trying to sketch out is the idea that a corner has been turned, and the corner for me is not capitalism coming to India, because I think capitalism is as good as it is bad when it plays out in a place like this. My point is more that a certain idea has come into Indians through these changes, and they've come into a lot of poor Indians and not just rich Indians, although the poor are much less able to implement the idea. And the idea is simply that I, as a human being, as a self, matter, that I should make my fate, that other people should not, whether it's my family or the government or the landlord in the village, should not control who I can become. And I have found this idea when I talk to wage laborers in the farms in India, and I've found this idea obviously in metropolitan areas. The idea is very powerful, and it's the kind of idea that Tocqueville found when he traveled in this country in the 19th century. And surely when he traveled in this country in the 19th century, there were a lot of poor people still and a lot of people left out. But he found this kind of democratic idea of people feeling they mattered. And finding that idea, in a way, foreshadowed a lot of the actual material progress. Because once people have that idea of themselves, it's actually pretty tough to be a ravenous landlord or a kind of stupid government bureaucrat or an exploitative corporation. That idea agitates very powerfully against all who would challenge it. But the caller is absolutely right that the work of India over the next many decades is to make the veneer of modernization not just a veneer.
We just have about 5 minutes left. We have some other callers here. Let's go to Spring Bay for another. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Curious to know about the relationship with the Hindus and the Sikhs. Is there tension there? Could there be potential for conflict as India continues to modernize? Do you understand, Mike?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's not just Hindus and Sikhs. It's Hindus and Muslims, probably most worryingly, and a number of other groups. It depends how you look at it. I mean, I think there's no question that India remains a place of kind of extraordinary low-level violence. And if you kind of just scan the newspapers for stories of small riots in different towns and incidents triggered by religion and other divisions, there's stuff all the time. On the other hand, it's a country of a billion people, so it's hard to kind of gauge what's a kind of normal level and what's extraordinary. The one positive sign is that the politics of kind of religious baiting seems, at least for now, to be a less salient politics than it was 10 years ago. And the principal division then between the two leading parties, the BJP and the Congress, was really about secularism and the degree to which India was a kind of pluralist nation or, in the BJP's view, a kind of Hindu civilization that had place for others but that was fundamentally a Hindu civilization. And the BJP, I think, has found that that politics is not the most effective politics, and they've lost two elections in a row, which doesn't happen very often in India, and have started to turn much more towards good governance as their theme. And I think that's a symbol that as the country changes, as people change, as aspirations change, people are much less interested in identity-based politics of a kind, of that kind of religious baiting, and much more interested in uplift. And on the other hand, caste-based politics is actually increasing in India, even as the caste system weakens as a kind of source of job control. Caste-based political parties that kind of proclaim caste solidarity are actually doing very well in certain parts of India. So as always in India, it's a very mixed bag.
What is the current strength of the Hindu belief in India? They've got, like you say, the Muslims in the north and Buddhists, I guess, around them, Christian missionaries. Are the Hindus holding their own? And I'll listen and get off the line. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what you mean by are they holding their own, but I think one of the things that's very interesting is there's a kind of general trend around the world of secularization in with the coming of modernity. But I think in India, what's occurring is a more nuanced picture of people having a kind of secularized sense of God and destiny don't control what I do in my life. But in many ways, people are going to temple more and fasting on Tuesdays to observe certain divine commandments. So you could also argue that as India is becoming more westernized and less at the same time, it's becoming more religious and less at the same time.
Mm. We're down here. We have a couple of minutes. One of the things that you have written about here in the book, and I am, again, thinking back to a couple of callers back, is the fact that there is a militant revolutionary Maoist movement in the country, and there are people who definitely are not
happy about the direction India is going. That just raises this question of, you know, some of the changes that we've talked about. I'm sure a lot of people would see them as positive, but not everybody does. Are there people who, in fact, don't think that India is going in a good direction, and what are they doing about it?
There are many people who don't, and I spent time in the book with two Maoist revolutionaries, and I essentially asked them to be my kind of intellectual tour guides, going over the same terrain that I had seen through the billionaire's eyes and through the eyes of a kid in a small town who rose from poverty. I said, "What do you see when you see that same scenery?" And what they see is very interesting, and one has to decide whether one agrees or not. But what they see is that India was this very layered, hierarchical, feudal, village-based society that gave way at independence in 1947 to this kind of socialist experiment of trying to make everyone equal and nation-building and dams for the new India and all of this. And that has given way now to this kind of new neoliberal capitalist India that, as they see it, is not continued forward movement away from the old feudal world, but is a kind of re-feudalization. Now, that's hard to understand, but what they say is the kind of software engineer who lives in a gated community from which villagers have been kicked out and generates his own power and generates his own water and works 15-hour days and suffers impotence and marital strife and children never see him because he's this new economy worker bee. He's in many ways as diminished, his humanity is as diminished as the old, you know, peasants on the estates. I certainly think it's a very different situation, but it's a reminder that progress is complicated and that at least we should not kind of simply view whatever happens to a developing country like this as forward motion. One has to really think about is moving forward always moving forward.
Hmm. Well, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. And just to again nod to one of the earlier callers, this is a very rich and very complicated place. So it's easy to, in an hour-long interview, it's easy to oversimplify. There is much more here, and if you're interested in reading more about India today, you might want to take a look at the book that we mentioned. The title of the book is India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. It's published by Times Books by our guest Anand Giridharadas. He writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and also the New York Times Online. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, David, and to your callers for great questions.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show on January 7th. Many past programs from Focus are available there. You can listen anytime you like. Just go to willill.illinois.edu. And we hope that at some time in the future also we will be able to arrange a program on prevention treatment of stroke. That was the topic that we were expecting to have on this morning's program.
Tonight, an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Michelle Norris. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tonight from 8 to 10 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
And coming up next, we have the usual mix of news and weather and sports and features, all part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. We're online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 9:14, that's up 6. The May contract up 5.75 at 9.24.5. In Chicago, March wheat 8.34.5, down 3/4. May 8.61.5, down 1/4. March corn 6.44, down 11.25. May 6.53.75, down 11.25. July 6.58.5, down 11. September 6.12.25, down 9. March, beans, 13.85 and a half, down 19. May, 13.96 and a quarter, down 18 and 3 quarters. July, 14.02 and 3 quarters, down 19 and a quarter. August, 13.77 and a half, that's down 19 and a half. Soybean meal, the March contract, 3.75.70, down 4.50. March oil, 56.36, down 82. February live cattle, 106.27 and a half, down 50. April, 111.20, down 47 and a half. January feeder cattle, 126.05, down 30. March, 124.62 and a half, down 92 and a half. And February lean hogs, up $1 at 81.65. Outside markets, March crude, 86.54, down 133. The U.S.